Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, now in its third year, the war in Yemen and resulting casualties, starvation, illness, and displacement has been declared by the UN the worst humanitarian crisis in the world. Images, like those from early August of Yemeni schoolchildren on a field trip, killed by bombs employed by the Saudi-led coalition, but made and sold by the U.S., have touched many Americans' hearts. But what's the bridge from concern to change? We'll talk about the crisis in Yemen and the U.S. responsibility with Shireen Al-Adeimi, Assistant Professor of Education at Michigan State University. Al-Adeimi's recent article with Sarah Lazar, "Trump Quietly Overrides What Little Civilian Protections Remain in Yemen War," appeared recently in These Times. Also on the show, elite media reported Education Secretary Betsy DeVos's claim that her rewrite of rules on rape, assault, and harassment in schools were about fairness to all parties, not just students who survived assault, but those wrongly accused of assault, as the Washington Post had it. And media, a few anyway, reported the fact that assault survivors groups protested outside DeVos's event announcing the new rules, to which they were not invited. Largely off the page, the questions the latter fact raises about the former. Alyssa Peterson is advocacy and policy coordinator with the group Know Your Nine. That's Title IX. She joins us to help fill in that gap. All of that's coming up, and we'll get right to it. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. It is disheartening that with tens of thousands of people killed, millions in need of assistance, at least a million affected by the largest cholera outbreak in history, and no clear end in sight to the violence behind it all, that the Washington Post would feel a need to run a piece headed "Five Reasons the Crisis in Yemen Matters." Coverage is better than silence, of course, but as the war on Yemen is in its third year now, one would hope that U.S. media would be in the business of regularly illustrating why the crisis matters, and specifically why it should matter to people in the U.S., whose government continues to play an active, central role in the war. That angle has not been corporate media's approach, more typically represented by this Reuters piece that describes the peace talks set to begin as we record this show, September 6th, as, quote, aimed at getting the Saudi-backed government and the Iranian-aligned Houthi movement to work toward halting the fighting, removing foreign forces, and establishing a unity government, close quote. U.S. citizens are poorly served by reporting that consigns our government's role in conflict to the background, and Yemenis certainly even more so. We're joined now by Shireen Al-Adeimi. She's been working to bring attention to the crisis in Yemen. She's an assistant professor of education at Michigan State University. She joins us now by phone from East Lansing. Welcome back to Counterspin, Shireen Al-Adeimi.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we spoke with you last December, and the tolls of death, of displacement, of illness have only gotten worse since then. But today we hear maybe some conversations will be had in Geneva in terms of bringing the war on and in Yemen to an end. What would you say has changed since we spoke last winter? I want to say I see more opposition, more acknowledgement of the U.S. responsibility, but maybe I'm just thinking wishfully.
No, I think there's definitely been more awareness, first and foremost, which has prompted, in return, more opposition to the U.S.'s role specifically. And I was surprised that I was turning on the channels and watched full coverage of the bus bombing on CNN. And that is not something that has been happening before in any kind of consistency. And when we have had information about the war in Yemen, we've not really heard about the U.S.'s role in the conflict, which, of course, is what's keeping this conflict alive. So I think there's been some changes there. But unfortunately, it took, you know, such a drastic turn for the worse. It took the murder of 44 schoolchildren on a school bus coming back from a field trip, and they were bombed by the Saudi-led coalition using American weapons. And it took for that event to finally bring some kind of attention in the media and some kind of scrutiny about U.S. role. But, you know, at least here we are.
Yes, Counterspin had reported that MSNBC, which is sometimes looked to as the resistance media, you know, had gone basically a year with silence on Yemen. But then there was a very affecting piece by Chris Hayes after that school bus attack that did point to the role of the U.S. in terms of saying, you know, viewers who are watching this and are upset, there is something you can do because it is our government that is playing such a key role in supporting the Saudi coalition there. So not just the coverage, but the acknowledgement that there's something for U.S. citizens to do here.
Exactly. And Chris has since had me on his podcast where we talked for an hour about the roots of the conflict and specifically the U.S.'s role. So I think, again, this is encouraging that we're not just talking about this conflict now as some faraway thing that's happening without our support or consent. We're speaking about it as we should, which is this is a U.S.-backed, Saudi-led conflict.
Well, we heard, and particularly in the wake of that August 9th attack, we did hear language about protecting civilians, but talk is cheap, notoriously. You and Sarah Lazar reported for In These Times on actual moves by Donald Trump that show the real priority that he places on civilian lives. It kind of went under most media's radar. Can you tell us about that?
Right. So Congress passed a defense bill for 2019, the NDAA, and there were some senators and Congress people who had worked together to try to introduce some provisions into this defense bill to ensure that U.S. dollars are not spent toward refueling the Saudi-led coalition's jets, because this is one of the main functions of the U.S. in Yemen, trying to refuel Saudi air jets. I think the provisions were a good start. They were weak to begin with because they included some loopholes. Well, you know, they mentioned that Secretary of State could just issue a waiver, and they said that mid-air refueling can continue to occur if the Saudis and Emiratis are showing that they're trying to prevent civilian life. This is very vague terminology, of course. The Saudis have just repeatedly said, yeah, we're not targeting civilians, and that's been enough. You know, nonetheless, there were some provisions that were there. And in his signing statement, Trump essentially said that these infringe on his rights as president and he would just ignore them. So what is the point then of including something like this if the president could just go on and say, well, I'll do what I want. I can just ignore whatever provisions are there.
Spain, I just heard, canceled delivery of 400 bombs that Saudi Arabia had bought, and they're giving their money back. It seems as though this kind of, oh, our hands are tied, you know, all we can do is sort of vaguely wave at the idea of civilian casualties. There are concrete things that the U.S. could be doing here if the goal were to stop the violence.
One of the things that Congress has attempted twice, once in the House and once in the Senate, was introducing the War Powers Resolution. It's basically a bill that says, let's vote on the U.S.'s presence in Yemen. And it would be binding if Congress voted for the U.S. to stop supporting Saudi Arabia. It would be a binding bill. The one time it was introduced in the Senate by Senator Sanders, they didn't end up voting on the bill itself. They voted to table it. You know, I think it was pretty close. 44 senators voted not to table it, but still. And when it was introduced in the House last year, it was stripped of its privileged status, which meant that it couldn't even go to a vote. There wasn't going to be a debate on it. But actually, right this morning, about an hour ago, members of Congress, led by Adam Smith, have announced that they're working toward another War Powers Resolution in September, and that they are trying to, again, get the U.S. to end its support of the Saudi-led coalition in Yemen, acknowledging that there are all these civilian deaths and that we are facilitating this war. I think I'd like to just include, again, a message of empowerment that since this bill is being worked on now to, you know, have people call their representatives in Congress and urge them to support the bill.
What thoughts do you have about the potential for the peace talks that are meant to be starting today in Geneva?
It sounds like the Houthis have not arrived yet. I read something about them not being able to secure safe return by the UN and other things that they had said they wanted that have not been met yet. So right now you have the Saudi-led coalition's representatives, aka the Yemeni government, in Geneva waiting to have these talks. I think if the Houthis make it there, I'm hopeful that this would lead to some kind of resolution. But like you said, there's been so much misinformation about this war, and I think it's intentional. there's this Iran-allied vocabulary that is just now fact. It's difficult to tell people, well, actually, Iran is not involved in this conflict because they've just taken it as fact. So we'll see what happens. We'll see if people are actually serious about ending this war. Of course, nothing will end if the U.S. continues to support the Saudi Arabians and if Saudi Arabia continues its attack on what is a sovereign country and should be respected.
Being portrayed in the media as a humanitarian disaster, I think, can spur some people to think, oh, what we need to do is get in there, is intervene. And I know I asked you this back in December. I just would like to underscore it. Yemenis aren't saying, please intervene, please come save us. That's not the message out of Yemen.
It's the complete opposite. It's that we've only gotten to this point because of foreign intervention. This was a civil war back in 2015. It would have started as a civil war, ended as a civil war. Yemen has seen many civil wars, and we've gone through it and continue to rebuild after that. And it's never gotten to these levels of humanitarian crisis. We're talking about the world's worst humanitarian crisis. If it remained in Yemen as a civil war, the ports wouldn't have been blockaded. People wouldn't be starving. Every 10 minutes, a child dies in Yemen from starvation and disease. And so we've only gotten to this point because of foreign intervention. So I believe, and many Yemenis who are still fighting and resisting and waiting for all of this to be over in Yemen, believe that let Yemenis solve their own problems, and we're not asking for any saviors. We're asking for people to stop intervening in Yemen.
We've been speaking with Shireen Al-Adeimi, Assistant Professor of Education at Michigan State University. Thank you so much, Shireen Al-Adeimi, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Headlines can do a lot of work. Take the August 29th New York Times news story, for example, headed "New U.S. Sexual Misconduct Rules Bolster Rights of Accused and Protect Colleges." Readers are tipped, you might say, that previous to proposed rules by Education Secretary Betsy DeVos, those accused of rape, sexual assault, or harassment on college campuses had weak or inadequate rights, and that colleges faced some sort of danger or vulnerability, presumably to being unfairly portrayed as places where such acts occur. What's missing between the prevalent presentation of new rules on sexual assault in schools as a common sense move towards fairness and the fact that no sexual assault survivors' representatives were on the guest list when Betsy DeVos announced the new rules? Maybe what's in between is real life. We're joined now by Alyssa Peterson. She's Policy and Advocacy Coordinator for Know Your Nine, a survivor and youth-led project that aims to empower students to end sexual and dating violence in their schools. She joins us now by phone from Connecticut. Welcome back to Counterspin, Alyssa Peterson.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, we'll get to particular elements of these proposed rules, but first I just wanted to ask you to address the real-world context of this intervention. Education Secretary DeVos's declaration, quote, "Every survivor of sexual misconduct must be taken seriously. Every student accused of sexual misconduct must know that guilt is not predetermined. These are non-negotiable principles," close quote. Putting those forward as twin tenets suggests the definition of the problem that's being addressed here. And I just wonder how closely you think that hews to reality.
So I think that her rules do not address what she's talking about because they do not take survivors' experiences seriously. We don't know what the final rule will look like, but letting schools off the hook for abusing survivors of sexual assault is not a way to protect their education. And generally, the rules have the effect of allowing schools to not be held accountable for violence that is perpetrated off campus, particularly with respect to fraternities. And then also the rules are crafted to discourage survivors from coming forward and endow accused students with procedural rights that are not given to survivors, which is effectively stacking the deck against survivors who need their perpetrators disciplined in order to stay in school.
Well, what is it about the rules in particular? They seem different in the kind of evidence they require and the amount of appeals that they allow. But what are some particular elements that you say stack the deck, as you say?
The most concerning aspect is allowing schools to not, as I mentioned previously, address harassment off campus. Mm-hmm. These rules are particularly ill-timed given Michigan State University and Ohio State University. In both of those cases, Dr. Strauss maintained a personal office off campus, which he used to abuse students. And then Nasser would routinely abuse gymnasts at a facility associated with the U.S. gymnastics team off campus. And in Betsy DeVos's vision, the school should not be held accountable for those abuses, even if they're perpetrated by people who are affiliated with the school. So the off-campus piece is, for us, one of the most concerning aspects about the rule. We're also concerned that the rule is designed to deter people from reporting. For example, the rule would permit people who are accused of rape to directly cross-examine the survivor, which is extremely intimidating, and for many people, myself included, would deter someone from going through a disciplinary proceeding. And previously, the Obama administration tried to strike a balance by allowing the accused student to ask questions of the survivor through a hearing panel, which was intended to allow for a full examination of the issues while making sure that the survivor would not be too intimidated to participate. But at this point, that balance has been removed, so it's effectively discouraging survivors from seeking discipline. And then, as you mentioned, there are these inequitable procedural rights that are given to accused students and not survivors. For example, one such procedural right is only accused students can be allowed to appeal. And because Title IX is a civil rights law, in a civil proceeding, both parties are always allowed to appeal. And because survivors experience procedural violations in the same way as accused students, there's no reason why they should not also be able to appeal.
Thank you. And I think there's a real absence of data, frankly, in the news stories about it. And so when you just get Betsy DeVos saying, well, survivors of sexual misconduct have to be taken seriously, and those accused of sexual misconduct have to be taken seriously, it presents an idea that this is a corrective, and it's a corrective to a scenario in which, to put it simply, you know, lots of women lie about being assaulted, and we need to check their ability to do that because they're abusing that ability. And so I just want to ask you, in terms of everything we know about campus sexual assault and assault in schools, it sounds like a solution without a problem.
Yes. What we do know is that 1 in 5 college students and a large number of high school students were experienced sexual violence in education. And that statistic has been replicated over, there was a national survey of 27 different colleges. There's been national surveys conducted generally. The 1 in 5 number, or even 1 in 4, appears to be the prevalence number. By contrast, some schools have reported how many students they discipline a year. Many times it's fewer than 10. And when you think about the prevalence rate of sexual violence and then the sort of drop-off in the survivors who come forward to report the assault, then the survivors who go through the disciplinary proceeding, and then the number of people found responsible, they're completely different. And for DeVos to focus on fear of over-discipline as the same a level of magnitude as prevalence of sexual assault is just misleading. But for our part, we are deeply concerned both that survivors are not getting a fair hearing, but that also we don't think anyone should be disciplined if they did not perpetrate sexual assault. So Know Your Nine has consistently and continues to call for strong procedural rights for both parties, whereas Betsy DeVos only wants strong procedural protections for accused students.
What do you make of the change in, or is it a change in, the definition of harassment? It seems to be saying things only rise to the order of, you know, of action if it makes it impossible for a person to access their education.
That's another way for Betsy DeVos to restrict the number of complaints received by the school. It actually somewhat mirrors precedent when people sue, and very few people are successful when they sue their school.
Right.
So for us, what was important is that the Office for Civil Rights took a broader view to the types of harassment that can compromise students' education. And when the department took that view and enforced it, schools took violence seriously and acted proactively to put steps in place, whereas under these current standards, schools are not incentivized to do much to help survivors because they can do very little and satisfy the standard proposed by the DeVos administration.
Well, one of my complaints about the sort of broad strokes nature of media coverage is there are a lot of unattributed claims, things like college leaders have long complained that the, you know, previous regulations were too broad, and those would be rules around what a school or an institution can be said to have known, you know, when things were happening on campus. I wonder what disincentive is in place for a school to just never know what's happening, because we understand that it's a PR thing. Clearly, if you're known as a campus where assaults have occurred, that matters to what is a, you know, an organization that wants to keep going. But I just wonder if you lower the standard of when the school is said to have reasonably known what was going on, where's the disincentive there for them just to never report?
I think there's a strong incentive to avoid knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
In the current structure, schools are required to have their employees pass on reports of harassment and assault to a Title IX coordinator, which will then trigger a school's legal obligation to respond to correct the hostile environment created by the abuse. But at this point, they now have an incentive to deter the mid-level reporters from passing on information because they don't actually want to know about the extent of violence on campus. They also perhaps have now an incentive to avoid doing climate surveys because that actually provides them with information that could be used to establish that they knew that there was a climate of violence on campus. So, as in the same way that Betsy DeVos has given massive giveaways to for-profit schools and allowed schools to discriminate against kids with disabilities, this is yet another way to sort of empower the higher ed lobby at the expense of the civil rights of students she's in charge of protecting.
Well, you've said that Know Your Nine is invested in the rights of people accused of sexual assault. And although that's, you know, one of the things that I dislike so much about media is the way they seem to present the zero-sum frame, you know, where women who don't want to be assaulted are a special interest group. And, you know, it just makes sense to balance their claims, you know, with other interest groups. You know, I wonder, stepping outside that framework, what would good policy look like, do you think?
The department has to do more to hold schools like Baylor, Michigan State, and Ohio State accountable. It's clear that under the current enforcement scheme, they did not feel the pressure to stand up and protect students from serial abusers. And what is happening right now is that the department is closing investigations left and right and trying to exempt campuses from dealing with violence that occurs by students enrolled in the program but off campus. And in order to correct that, the department would have to hire more staff and engage in systemic enforcement, which Betsy DeVos has specifically declined to do. And then I also think a better policy would hold schools accountable when they violate the rights of accused students and survivors. And that requires having strong procedural protections for both parties and holding schools accountable when they violate them. For example, the Obama administration found a school not compliant because they did not respect the rights of the accused student. And the Obama administration also found schools not compliant for disrespecting the procedural rights of survivors. So for me, it's a question of how can we create strong procedural rights that test the evidence while not traumatizing students who participate, and then create the transparency so we know what are the outcomes of these adjudications and are there disparities in for race discrimination for both survivors of color who come forward and accused students of color in these proceedings.
Yeah, that actually reminds me, right before I started to talk to you, I saw a show, a Making Contact show, that was talking with folks from historically black colleges and universities about sexual assault on their campuses. It's yet another aspect of the issue that seems to be largely missing from corporate media's coverage, even though they kind of play a race undertone sometimes, like we talked about last November. And so let me just ask you finally, what would you ask for from reporters, more of or less of, or any thoughts about the way this issue gets covered?
The HBCU issue fits into the problem that a certain survivor's perspective is covered, and it's covered to the extent that the reporter will actually impose their view of what an ideal survivor would behave on Know Your Nine organizers. Hmm. Within our team, we call that fitting the survivor slot. And the person in the survivor slot, it's almost always a she. This person's incredibly vindictive. And there's no room for the survivor to feel ambivalent about punishment for the person who raped them or critical of using the criminal justice system that harms survivors and people accused of sexual assault. There's no sort of room for a more complicated conversation about what accountability looks like. And that particularly applies to students of color who face sort of competing pressures about knowing that the police will deal with their perpetrators in ways that are racist, but trying to find accountability and safety within their own communities. But the default survivor narrative doesn't create space for that kind of conversation. I think another sort of recent flaw in reporting has been reporters' decision to treat feminists as a homogenous group. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know if you saw that there was an article on Professor Ronnell at NYU where a number of prominent feminists like Judith Butler have come forward to defend her. And when a prominent news outlet reported on the story, they actually lumped in a Know Your Nine organizer as supportive of the feminists who were defending the professor accused of harassment. And they just assumed that feminists stand with other feminists, right, even when they abuse and discriminate against students. And that couldn't be farther from the truth. And in fact, the more accurate story would have described the support among feminists for the male student who alleged harassment. But in sum, a lot of journalists, in the service of tying up a story neatly and putting a bow on it, rely on stereotypes about how victims behave in a really sort of flattened ideological conflict between feminists. And I think it's important that we have more nuanced conversations on this issue and that reporters participate in that project.
We've been speaking with Alyssa Peterson. She's Policy and Advocacy Coordinator at Know Your Nine. You can find their work online at knowyournine, that's 9ix.org. Alyssa Peterson, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch group based in New York. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.